You're listening to the John DePietro Show. Folks, joining us right now, he is a columnist with the Boston Globe. It is Dan McGowan. And Dan, I want to just start off. That was a remarkable overtime win by the PC Friars, a team that, I mean, you lose your best player dominant, and boy, they have two players in the team that are just completely rallying. That was an impressive win.
Yeah, and a desperate win, too. I mean, they kind of laid an egg over the weekend against Villanova, and, you know, you could easily see, when you have, like, a disheartening performance like that, given sort of everything they're facing, you could easily see the season kind of going in a tailspin. I mean, you know, you're going, even with a home game, Creighton was a, you know, top 20 team in the country. Easily could have been a loss last night, and then suddenly you're two games under 500, and before you know it, you lose a couple more, and you know this, you're suddenly down, you know, with the Georgetowns and the DePauls of the world, a little better, but you're in that range. But big win last night, and now you start to look at it, and you spin it the other way. You look at the schedule; next three games are all winnable games. And suddenly you could be, 9-6 heading down the stretch, which would put you squarely in the NCAA tournament conversation. And you're right. I mean, I think they're just getting they're getting such spirited performances. I mean, you look at the minutes the starters are playing. I mean, obviously this overtime last night, but I think they had three guys go 40 minutes plus last night. And that Devin Carter, I don't know what he's going to be in the NBA, but he is a special college player.
He is.
He makes big shots. He plays hard, rises to the occasion. I think there's still something to be excited about with this PC team as we head into February. The February schedule.
What a season for the rookie coach as well. I'm glad things are turning out. He seems to be the real deal. I'm very impressed by the hire. You're exactly right over the weekend. The way they bounce back at home like that, it's something to get excited about. Folks, in the Boston Globe, incredible extensive coverage of obviously this ongoing situation with the bridge. Dan McGowan, the latest now, environment and toxic. Union leaders are speaking out at Rhode Island DOT about Peter Alviti. I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts on that.
Well, it's stunning to me in that as you and I have talked about in recent weeks, you know, Peter Alviti is a through and through union guy. And I know, you know, not all unions are the same and things like that, but you never, very rarely do you hear people willing to go, quite frankly, on the record about their frustrations with Peter Alviti. And I think, honestly, you know, part of it is, you can say it's his popularity. I think part of it is he is a guy who, you know, everybody knows has lots of respect in the laborers' world, lots of respect kind of at the state house. And so, you know, it is I think it's a dangerous move. A dangerous, I mean, just like professionally to kind of cross Peter Alviti. But what you're seeing here is what happens, I think, almost every time you have a major, you know, a major scandal or challenge or issue, which is people are starting to feel a little more comfortable. I think they're starting to maybe sniff a little blood and, you know, potentially seeing the writing on the wall that there could be a change in leadership here. I'll be honest, I'm still a little bit skeptical that there. I think Governor McKee seems to be signaling that he's going to stick with Peter Alviti. But, you know, you start to get the drip, drip, drip of now who's upset and who's, you know, who's frustrated with the culture in that place. My guess is this won't be the last you hear about some of the concerns around Peter. We heard a lot about, you know, how wonderful he is for a long time. And I think now you start to, you know, again, as people start to sniff a little blood, you start to hear the other side of things and some of the frustrations. You know, what I don't know, and I trust my colleague Brian Amaral is a very good reporter and who did a good job getting people again to go on the record to talk about this, is what we just don't know, you know, are there contractual issues that, you know, has people griping. You know, we always see that on the kind of the teachers union side. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But again, I don't think this will be the last time you hear about kind of a subpar work environment there at the Department of Transportation.
Dan McGowan, what did you make of the fact that first DOT charged news organizations for the money and then Governor McKee seemingly stepped in and then started refunding the money.
I thought it was a smart move, I suppose, of the governor to realize that it's a not a good move to to charge different prices for for two different media outlets for generally the same information. I mean, this is one of those things where I swear I don't get as caught up and hung up on the cost of public records requests. I understand, we're asking for people's emails and text messages. It's not the easiest thing to do. This is one of those things, though, where rather than kind of be very secretive and try to negotiate these one-offs with each news outlet, I don't understand why you don't call the Globe, the Journal, Channel 12, 10, and 6, and whoever else, and say, hey, you guys are all asking for roughly the same thing. If you all put in $50, then it'll solve all the problems, and you're not gonna have anyone complaining about, who paid what, and that sort of thing. It was just an unnecessary distraction for them, and they really made a big mistake with it because, the truth is, those initial batch of emails, there wasn't. It's not like there was some big smoking gun. I think the charging the media story ended up actually like it forced more conversation about these emails than there probably would have been if they had just been, somewhat more transparent and just more straightforward with the cost. But I should say, I criticize the governor a lot. Good on the governor for realizing it was a mistake. Just that should never have happened in the first place.
What was your reaction and when Governor McKee basically, in a radio interview, said he wasn't aware a press conference was happening on December 11th until, in fact, that Director Alviti announced that the bridge was being closed?
My jaw dropped, John.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I think a lot of you, I'm curious, maybe you could offer some insight having done radio for your career. I'm always interested in the non-radio media, so TV, print, that doesn't pay attention to what, the governor or the mayor or the DOT director says on some of these interviews, because it's incredibly revealing. And so many, like so many of my colleagues in the non-radio media, like pretend or actively ignore what gets said. But it's stunning to me that the governor of Rhode Island says, yeah, I wasn't even aware that they were going to have this press conference. I knew that we were going to communicate it. Well, yeah, you were closing the Washington Bridge in rush hour. I hope you were aware that there was going to be some communication. I don't understand how you didn't demand to have a press conference. I mean, that closure, and by the way, everybody took it live, as all the TV stations. That's the kind of thing where the governor of Rhode Island could make one phone call to each of the TV stations to say, hey, you got it. You guys have to preempt your news. You have to do this. It's an emergency situation. And I'll be there and I'll explain everything. And every one of them would have, of course, including radio too, would have, of course, broken in from their newscast and covered it. It's just stunning to me how the word, I think I used this last week with you too, John, is just lackadaisical at times. I think the governor can be, he's very flippant about, yeah, sure, we didn't, I didn't know about this one. And then there wasn't communication at all over the weekend about this. And of course, the governor didn't even know until Monday, he says Monday afternoon. I do not think, honestly, and the governor's, including from me and definitely from you, the governor's gotten plenty of criticism. I don't think he's gotten enough criticism for not being in the loop about, about the most important major kind of crisis the state has seen in some time.
Dan McGowan, and again, folks, we're speaking with Dan McGowan of the Boston, columnist of the Boston Globe. You go back to his predecessor, Governor Gina Raimondo appeared on television with Dr. Nicole Alexander Scott to announce that it was basically the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
And what's more remarkable is not only was he unaware that his director of DOT was going to go on television, I still can't wrap my head around the fact that at 5:20 he left the State House and went to the Hope High School basketball practice.
And he acts, what's he acts like, well, of course I did because of my education, plan. I'm sorry, but basketball practice is going to take, you're going to have to skip it when you have the Washington Bridge closing down. This is not, a tiny little bridge in a small place in Rhode Island. This is, 100,000 people travel over this thing every day. The governor of Rhode Island needs to be there. And what's interesting about this, John, is I was extremely critical of the governor, immediately after he did that. I think you and I talked later in the week, and things had been, it seemed like they were getting better. It was almost like, oh, they told us it'll be a couple of weeks to get the emergency lanes open. Boom, they were open by Friday. I'll bet you they said it'll be 3 months to, fix the bridge. I'll bet you it'll be done by, January 1st or something like that, and they'll be able to, tout a big victory. The thing is, they acted, and he's acting like because they kind of got those emergency lanes open and had a good, let's say a bad rollout. I would say letter grade F on the Monday, but that they got better, that they somehow have done a really good job here. I mean, we're now talking about potentially, a year or two minimum to fix the bridge if it is in fact needing kind of a full repair. This has been not just disastrous communication, but it's been incredibly poor planning. It's been, setting people's hopes up and then now really dashing them, I think, from a leadership perspective. I just can't fathom the idea that the governor has bungled this as much as he has.
And perhaps doesn't still understand the significance. Dave McGowan, as we're speaking, they've had another horrendous morning there where traffic is at a gridlock, and he seems more excited about this film that's already underway, this Ella McCray, or about a lieutenant governor that becomes governor. I mean, I kind of understand, okay, the excitement of it, but this is a problem that's not going away. I want to Lodge Pub and Eatery, 40 Breakneck Hill Road in Lincoln. Lunch, dinner, drinks in the lounge, especially this time of year. So much going on. They always have a nice crowd right there. Full bar, large dining area right there in the lounge. Easy to get to, whether it's lunch or dinner. A great meal is waiting for you at the Lodge Pub and Eatery. Think of this, since 1994. That's right, celebrating the big anniversary this year. I'll see you at the Lodge Pub and Eatery, 40 Breakneck Hill Road in Lincoln. Our guest is the columnist with the Boston Globe. It's Dan McGowan. Just quickly ask you about your thoughts on the Providence schools. The education commissioner certainly seems intent. She's got a plan. I'm just curious your thoughts that already, I think we're starting to see some of the stunts that are going to be pulled anytime she's trying to revamp, maybe merge some schools. You don't need all those schools. They have less students than they've had. What's going to happen, or what's your read right now in the Providence school situation?
Yeah, look, anytime they close schools, and, I've covered, God, going back to the Tavares administration, I've probably covered 10, I don't know, 15 school closures in my time. All, by the way, always underperforming. And severely so, in most cases, often lower enrollment, things like that. And it's always a crisis, right? It's always, we're going to protest and kids are going to walk out and we're going to rally the teachers and things like that. I think the challenge in this case, in the context here, is that Providence is going to close one of its smaller high schools, 360 High School. Is what we're not getting from the state is sort of the kind of a clear decision making that you would expect around this. Now, you would always get. You're always going to get criticism for school closures. There's no way around it. It's every community, everywhere. But this is one of those things that seemingly a decision was made sort of relatively quietly. the 360 school is not a good, a high performing school. None of them are, except for classical. And even classical has some obviously challenges as we've covered and talked about. But it is one of the schools that seemingly has a somewhat strong culture. The principal there is considered among the more highly kind of competent principals. The thing I would say about this, though, is that principal can find a new job. And if that principal's good enough, they can go to, you know, if they're really good, let's stick them in Mount Pleasant. Let's stick them in Hope. You know, these big schools where you have, you know, just incredibly, stunningly low academic performance. So, look, I don't blame the district and the commissioner for trying to make changes. I think that they have really struggled. You know, you go back to you and I when you know, we first started doing this segment years ago, you and I would regularly, I think, praise the education commissioner for how sort of open and honest and how she was taking kind of her show on the road and really building the case for the state takeover. What they have retreated to, especially since Governor McKee took office, is really this education committee, Infante Green, it kind of shows the same traits in some ways as Governor McKee. They're always convinced, you know, who's leaking, who's out to get me. You know, it's a lot of that kind of thing. And so I think sometimes they kind of create their own problem because, you know, they keep things really tight-lipped until they have to announce it. Then they get a bunch of uproar because they say, well, you're, you know, the teachers or the community says, well, you're being very secretive. And so, you know, this is another kind of situation where I think it's they've kind of screwed up the communication, even though probably in the long run, it's true that, you know, we've proven in Providence that big high schools don't seem to work, but little high schools don't seem to work. So, you know, trying to make another change is a reasonable decision. And again, this was a school that was, you know, by no means is performing exceptionally well.
I think, Dan McGowan, you're going to see a teacher strike in Rhode Island. Newton showed after 2 weeks they got what they wanted, and right now the McKee administration, the last thing they need with the bridge is a teacher strike. They'll fold.
I don't know if we go as far as a strike, but I'm not going to dismiss that. I think it is entirely, you know, something that could be in the cards. But you want to talk about leverage because of the fact that you don't want a Washington, you know, you've got the Washington Bridge going on. Remember, the Providence Teachers Union contract is a year contract. It ends August 31st. So you get it on the head. The Providence teachers are going to be, you know, really sniffing blood. And it reminds me a little bit of that, you know, heading into an election year, all those teachers shouting down Daryl Waters at his State of the City address, you know, embarrassing him in front of his mom and really, really, you know, again, almost like being so loud you couldn't hear the address. I think you could see another scenario where that type of thing happens, but this time with the governor.
Folks, you hear me mention roadmap. There's links to all the stories in the Globe, whether it be the Red Sox and Netflix or everything going on in our state, whether it be also soccer. And then, as I mentioned, incredible story on what's going on at that group home, St. Mary's, and also this story about the situation at DOT. Dan McGowan, right now, if you'd be so kind to just extend that offer to anyone who's listening.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for letting me do it. For everybody out there, it's very simple. Send me a blank email, rinews@globe.com, rinews@globe.com. I will sign you up. You'll start getting it first thing tomorrow morning.
Folks, he's Dan McGowan of the Boston Globe. Dan, great job, and we'll talk to you again.
Have a good weekend. Thanks.
AJ, drywall, plaster, home improvement, call them today for a free quote. You can also find them on Facebook, 401-323-9252. 323-9252. AJ, drywall, plasters, home improvement, frame to finish basements. What a difference it'll make in your basement. Acoustic ceilings. Look how beautiful your ceiling could be. New homes, additions. Also, commercial rehabs, painting, remodeling. Contact them today. It's a family-run business. AJ Drywall, Plaster, Home Improvements. Call for a free quote. What a difference they'll make in your home, your ceilings, floors, basements. 401-323-9252. What a difference. Beautiful walls and ceilings. 401-323-9252. You can also find them on Facebook. It's AJ Drywall, Plaster, and Home Improvements for your home or business. You're listening to the John DePietro Show. Folks, joining us right now, he is the executive editor at Newsbusters. It's Tim Graham. Tim, welcome to the John DePietro Show. Anxious to hear your thoughts on the fact that President Biden is going to be skipping what has become, number one, a tradition within the country, which is the interview of the president on the network carrying the Super Bowl before the game. But more importantly, it is a huge election year, and you would think the president would want this unique opportunity to speak to America.
Yes, you would. I mean, this tradition really kicked up with Barack Obama. He loved to do this interview. And usually it's very much a softball interview. The one I remember is when he and the NBC crew were testing the beer they were brewing at the White House. So that's what he's skipping.
Right.
But I think they're afraid of two things. They're afraid of just one question that's a little bit tough, and they're scared that he's going to say something silly to a very huge audience. You know, the way that he's been naming dead leaders of Europe, you know, he's going to probably start talking about quarterbacks that have been dead since the, you know, 90s. It matches their strategy to sort of hide him in general. This shouldn't be surprising, except for the massive audience he could communicate with.
Folks, again, we're speaking with Tim Graham, executive editor of Newsbusters at the Media Research Center. Now, Tim, as far as with President Biden and CBS, to go into this a little bit more, I believe they feel they're trying to spin it that they're seeking out, you know, less traditional ways. But it's hard to ignore the huge audience would be there. I don't think he'd have another opportunity before the election to reach such a large audience.
Absolutely. They're trying to say, well, we're talking to TikTok influencers and whatnot. Well, that might be good for a small section of voters under 30. But this is everyone. This is a massive audience of everyone, including the youth vote. So obviously, they're afraid of the entire country, every demographic, seeing him stumble and bumble. You just have to think that the Biden organizers are like, steer him around it. They don't want him engaging. They're afraid of what he's going to say. And the networks themselves, when he bumbles and stumbles and says, you know, I was talking to Mitterrand the other day when he's been dead since 1996, they don't play those clips.
Tim, as far as CBS, do we have an idea of maybe, would this be maybe a negotiation, meaning could the Biden White House have said, we'd like to have Gayle King, who's on the CBS Morning Show, or maybe some CBS reporter that they, you know, feel would in fact be favorable to the president?
I think so. I mean, Gayle King interviewed Barack Obama, and the interesting thing about that, of course, was that Gayle King was a donor to Obama. Gayle King has vacationed with the Obamas. Gayle King and Oprah were with the Obamas the night of the inauguration inside the White House. I mean, that's how chummy it could be. This is why it's funny. It's one thing last year when Fox News or Fox had the game, and the Biden people are like, we're not going on Fox News. And remember, Fox at that time was trying to say, we have this new platform called Fox Soul. You can be interviewed by actress Vivica A. Fox, who voted for you, and they still wouldn't take the deal.
Wow. Folks, again, it's Tim Graham, executive editor of Newsbusters at the Media Research Center. We're talking just a couple more moments on the fact that President Biden is going to forego this interview. Now, Tim, is this also, if you look at, I can't recall when's the last time President Biden sat down for an extensive interview, and it does seem as though they feel the potential gaffe that could come into play outweighs any benefit from the interview.
I think so. Now, remember, you could do a taped interview, which allows you to say, hey, guys, can we cut that part? You know, the last interview on CBS was with Scott Pelley for 60 Minutes. And it was we joked about it. It was like they were, ushering him around, trying to make it as positive as possible. You know, this 60 Minutes used to be known as this hard-hitting show. And it was hard-hitting when they'd interview Trump. But when they interview Democrats, obviously there was a long string of Barack Obama softball interviews on 60 Minutes. And 60 Minutes has done the same thing for Biden when the Biden team has allowed them in. They could have requested Scott Pelley again to do a Super Bowl interview.
Sure.
They just don't want to do an interview.
Before I let you go, are there any other memorable presidential interviews? I can remember, like, Bill O'Reilly. Fox would let Bill O'Reilly, a Fox News channel, I believe, do the presidential interview. But it did kind of become, the Super Bowl, as we both know, has just morphed into this incredible, it's really the only one of the few events where everyone gathers around the television to watch. It did become part of the tradition that the president would be on the network carrying it. But any memorable ones prior that come to mind for you?
Yeah, well, I think that Obama had the audacity to take on Bill O'Reilly not once but twice, I believe. And,
yeah.
And the funny part about this is the Biden team's now saying, well, we want to let just people enjoy the game. Well, we should underline that there's like a 3 or 4 hour pregame for the Super Bowl. And what
right.
generally would happen would be the game's at 6:30 and they would put on the president's interview at like 5:10 Eastern. So it's not like you couldn't wait. Like, I'll turn it on when they sing the national anthem. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Tim, how can people learn more about Newsbusters at the Media Research Center?
Thanks. We're at newsbusters.org and, also have other websites, mrctv.org, censortrack.org, where you can follow what we're up to.
Tim, big fan of your work. Keep it up. Great to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again.
All right. Thanks.
Do you need a good plumber? I found the best plumber. JMB Plumbing. Call them today. All your plumbing needs. 401-743-9153. JMB Plumbing. They've been providing plumbing services for years. Skilled professionals stand behind their work. Guarantee you will be happy. Maybe it's repairing damaged water pipes, repair clogged pipelines, maybe replace a water heater, as well as all your plumbing needs. Call them now. It's JMB Plumbing, 401-743-9153. Nothing throws off your life or your home or your business. When you need plumbing service, you need someone reliable, someone who's professional, someone who'll handle the job and do it right. It's JMB Plumbing. Call them today. 401-743-9153, JMB Plumbing, and look for them on Facebook. Folks, joining us right now, he is the Rhode Island Secretary of State, is Secretary Greg Amore. Mr. Secretary, first of all, thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start what I think is interesting about voting. And this is something that you've inherited, but all states have different rules and regulations on how they operate. So I have found that that can be confusing for people because, people watch various, whether it's news programs, films, what have you, and they have an idea of what it's like in one state. It doesn't mean another state. What I'd like to try to clarify is Rhode Island's laws or rules or regulations regarding mail ballots. And it is certainly, and you tell us, but it's dramatically changed as a result of 2020 and then going forward. So if we could just start off with this process of how there are so many, quote, mail ballots out there, even though I don't know how many people are actually mailing them. They seem to be using the drop boxes, but if you could at least just start with that.
So there's some significant changes, but a mail ballot has been accessible without excuse since 2011. So that's not new. What is new is there is no longer a requirement for a notary witness or another witness. What is new is that you can apply for that mail ballot online through our office, as long as you have a current ID, a Rhode Island driver's license or Rhode Island state ID. And what is new is in 2020, mail ballot applications were sent to every Rhode Island registered voter. That is no longer the case. We are not sending applications to any voters. They have to either apply at their city or town hall or go through our online process. Again, the biggest change there is that no longer is there a witness signature required, and that kind of puts us in line with the vast majority of states.
Now,
and to tell you the truth, John, I anticipated that the mail ballot voting percentage would continue to rise, and it has not. Since the pandemic ended, it has kind of come back down. We have more Rhode Islanders voting in person on election day and early voting than we do by mail.
I want to also clarify where we may be, Mr. Secretary, in line to neighboring states. And you tell me whether or not it could be wrong. It's tough sometimes to find even a lot of accurate information on this because every state operates differently. But it's my understanding that in Rhode Island, or let's just say Connecticut, Massachusetts, it's limited to that maybe I want to gather all the ballots for people, members of my family. Maybe I want to gather ballots, people in my neighborhood. But there's a limit that I can't produce or, you know, deliver more than 10 ballots. It's my understanding in Rhode Island, it's unlimited compared to Mass and Connecticut that limit it at 10.
Yeah, so I know Connecticut is limited at 10. I'm not sure on Massachusetts, to tell you the truth. But yes, Rhode Island does not have a limit. And the idea is that you may, I think in Connecticut, it's restricted to immediate family members or someone that is living with you, domiciled with you. So Rhode Island doesn't restrict that, acknowledging the fact that there are many people who don't have someone like that, who could not identify a person, but may have a neighbor that was willing to do that. And even if it is a campaign operative, as long as that ballot is sealed, we're going to go and check the signature against the signature that is in the DMV file or from the voter registration file. And we're going to make sure that the barcode on that matches the barcode from the request. So as long as that ballot is sealed, no matter who is putting it in the mailbox or delivering it to the city or town hall or putting it in the drop box, you know, we're pretty confident that the signature matching and the process to get the mail ballot secures that ballot. But I do know that many states have different rules around ballot gathering. And I think some of them are frankly difficult to enforce. I don't know how you could enforce those rules across the board. Now, our drop boxes here in Rhode Island are monitored. They're under video surveillance when they're being used, but a U.S. mailbox is not. And that is still a way that many, many Americans deliver their mail ballot. So I think enforcement is difficult there. And I think when those rules and regulations and the law were being discussed, I think they were erring on the side of making sure that someone who was alone, someone who was disabled, someone who had issues but did not have immediate family members could still get their ballot delivered.
Now, you said, so our drop boxes are monitored. And why is that? If someone can deliver, in theory, someone could pull up and drop off 500, could drop off 1,000, or could drop off one. Why are they monitored?
So we don't want anybody to damage those boxes. We don't want anybody to put a foreign element in those boxes. We want to make sure that those boxes are secure. We want to make sure that someone is not trying to tip it over or do anything that would damage the box or try to get at the ballots. For sure. But even if someone were to deliver 100 ballots, let's say, we're going to go through the process of comparing that ballot, the signature on that envelope, to the signature that's on file. And that's a public process at the Board of Elections. That's not our office, as you know. That's the Board of Elections. And that's a public process. And there's a large screen that brings up the signature from the DMV, brings up a signature from the application, brings up a signature from the original registration. And two folks sit there and analyze that signature. They both have to agree. They're not both Democrats. They're either unaffiliated, one Democrat, one a Republican. And they both have to agree. If they don't agree, that ballot is not accepted. All right. So what then happens is the voter is contacted, and it's called ballot curing. And the voter then has to prove who they are before that ballot will be counted.
And I want to clarify, it's my understanding, you tell me I could be wrong, but an X is regarded as an acceptable signature.
So right now that is the case. There is legislation that is being promoted by the Board of Elections that would change that. And the Board of Elections, and we're supporting that legislation, that would change that so that someone who is disabled would have someone, and again, the regulations and the rules would have to be written around this. They would have someone that would witness and sign for them, and they would be on the list as that person's aide, the person helping that person vote. So that is, there is an existing law that allows an X based on someone who is disabled. But as I said, the Board of Elections is exploring a change to that to make that more secure. We have supported that change.
This could be a Board of Elections question, Mr. Secretary, but is there a number or percentage of those ballots that are routinely tossed out? For instance, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but in 2022, do we know, granted you were not in office, how many ballots end up actually in that scenario where they're being examined and then they're tossed out or challenged?
That is a Board of Elections question, but I can tell you that I have witnessed the process. And in the, I don't know, hour that I spent there looking at that process, there were a few that were not accepted. And to me, with the naked eye, not having been trained as those folks are in signature verification, it was pretty clear to me that there was an issue. And again, sometimes somebody may have had a stroke and that signature has changed. And that's why there's the cure process, so that that person can come in and say, I had a stroke. I'd like to establish a new signature. Here's my identification. This is who I am.
I'm going to follow up with you on only because I believe Massachusetts is also in line with Connecticut. So it kind of puts us, our two neighboring states, limited 10. Rhode Island is unlimited. I'm curious your thought on, we saw this in 2022, and I could be wrong. I think it's kind of a new dynamic, but you had candidates that one day of voting, but then they lost the election due to the mail ballots, so to speak, that were tallied in. I'm unfamiliar that has happened in the past, but just three high profile examples. The Helena Folks, Governor McKee, she one day of voting lost to him in the mail ballots. Alan Fung, one day of voting lost in the mail ballots. And Aaron Gukian, one day of voting lost the mail ballots to the lieutenant governor.
Well, I think they lost in the mail ballot and early voting combined. So it was not just mail ballots. It was the early process, the 20-day process, not including weekends. It was that and the mail ballots combined where they lost the election. Election day, they won the day. So that is accurate, but it wasn't just on mail ballots. That was also early in person. Okay. And early in person is exactly the same as same-day voting. And you know I'm a baseball guy. So five runs in the first inning is the same as five runs in the ninth inning.
Yep. And is there, what is the process that if someone did participate either a mail ballot or early voting, what if that person went to then go vote on election day?
They'd be in the system as having already voted or having already requested a mail ballot. And then if they are protesting that and say, well, that's not the case, they'll be allowed to vote a provisional ballot that will not be counted. And then the investigation will pursue as to where that mail ballot application was, where the mail ballot was, if they voted, and then that'll be clarified. And either that provisional ballot will not be counted or it will be counted because there was a snafu in the process.
Could you see, Mr. Secretary, a scenario where we shorten the length of time for early voting. We saw it, a lot of people are talking about it, especially it drew attention last late summer. The Democrat, the CD1 primary, we had someone was doing okay, but then dropped out. Could you see a scenario where they shorten the early voting?
It's been talked about. I know there are legislative proposals to do that. I would say, for this next presidential election, which I think is going to be a high turnout election, I don't think there's terrible excitement around it, but I think there'll be high participation around it. I would like to keep the date intact because it takes so much pressure off our folks at the polling locations on the same day. Just that those first 5 days take that pressure off, so there are no lines and there's no tension that would exist if there were long lines. But with that said, I do think there's probably a time where we can discuss a shorter period, but I would say that shorter period should include a weekend day. I think when if we do condense that period, there should be a weekend day so that we can serve. Rhode Island is a service industry state, right? So it's very difficult for some people to vote on election day. And if there are long lines, someone who may have a little time before they have to drop their child off at daycare or go back to work and they're working an hourly wage job, we want to make sure that's accessible to them. And that's kind of my focus. But we also want to make sure the system is secure. And anywhere where we see that there's an issue, we will try to make the system more secure. And I know you're aware of our proposal on the signature verification and the process in the nomination papers, which I was very vocal about early on, that I said the Board of Elections had the power to review in real time. And so we've proposed legislation that would clarify that they can review in real time and that they must identify the issue and the collector to the other 38 or 37 or 36 cities and towns. And you saw that play out, even though it's not law yet and not regulation, you saw that play out with the Ramaswamy signatures. And that's exactly how it
Yes.
worked. The Board of Elections saw it, they identified it, they checked in real time, and they identified the issue to the other cities and towns based on the signatures and the people that collected them. And that was an outside agency that
You
collected those
mentioned, and
signatures.
it is a campaign, you said, or a ballot could be collected by a campaign operative. Now, in the CD1 primary this past summer, there was one of the candidates that finished, there were a lot of candidates in the race. And this particular candidate,
Anna Cassata, she finished seventh. I get
correct.
this question all the time. She finished seventh and she had more mail ballot votes than in-person votes.
Correct.
Right. So
But does
first of all,
that
she finished
concern you?
seventh.
Especially, it's my understanding her operative is someone that also happens to be an elected official who sits on the city council.
I'm
So,
not aware of that.
yeah.
I'm not aware of that. I know this because I've been asked this question time and again. So my first answer to this question would be, I don't know who that person is, so I can't speak to that. But I would say if that's a strategy, it didn't work. When you finish seventh in a field of 12, that's not very effective. And secondly, I would say because of that district, and I ran statewide, so I know what that polling place looks like, there's not a lot of turnout there. And that particular candidate did not have a lot of money. So my guess is that the way they decided to run that campaign was to focus on mail ballots because you can track those, as you know, right? You know if somebody's requested one, you know if they've turned them in, and then you can kind of focus your attention. But I'd say that is only effective in a very small turnout, localized race. I do not think that's effective in a broad race. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it as a strategy. I think people use that as a strategy. I can't speak to who was collecting and what the issues were around that. I do know that if it's an emergency mail ballot, that person has to identify who they are and what campaign they're with and how many of those emergency mail ballots they're dealing with. And that's part of existing law.
One final question, and I want to clarify it. Is it legal in Rhode Island if someone's running for office and they tell a campaign operative, someone working on the campaign, I will pay you a certain amount of money per mail ballot that you collect?
So is that specifically illegal?
Correct. If someone would
I'm not sure.
operate that way, would they be violating any
I'm
type
not
of
sure.
law?
I think that campaigns pay operatives, period, to work for their campaign. And what those operatives or what those campaign employees are doing is vast. I know that people get paid to collect signatures. We saw that, right? We've seen that. We've witnessed that.
Correct.
And they do get paid in some cases by the signature. We've seen that. I think that was the case actually in the Ramaswamy case. In regard to a campaign operative picking up a ballot, I've never heard of somebody paying for that, and I don't know the legality around that. But I do know that the bill that was passed, the Let Rhode Island Vote Act, pulls campaign operatives out of this process by not allowing a notary signature, right? You know this, a lot of campaigns were hiring notaries, and those notaries would go and meet with that person and witness that signature. Well, that's putting the campaign right in the room. And so that's why I think that that part of Let Rhode Island Vote was smart, because it pulls the campaign out. You know, do I want that to happen? No, I don't want that to happen. But the reality is, we're still going to check the process. We're going to check those signatures. We're going to make sure the barcode is there. We're going to make sure that that matches up with what was applied for.
Folks, again, he is Rhode Island Secretary of State Greg Amore. Mr. Secretary, appreciate the time. Great to talk to you. And I hope this is the first of many conversations.
Thanks, John. Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Take care.
Propane Plus. Call them today. Heating and cooling in Rhode Island, 401-885-4209. In Massachusetts, 508-252-3359 for Propane Plus. Three generations you can always depend on Propane Plus for all your heating and cooling. Call them today, 401-885-4209. Three generations, they're available 24/7. For service and delivery, and they're going to serve you for a very long time. They have a great user-friendly website. You just log on at propaneplus.com, and then you type in your zip code, residential, commercial, Propane Plus, heating and cooling, always there for you. Give them a call today in Rhode Island, 401-885-4209, in Massachusetts, 508-252-3359, the Johnson family, three generations, heating and cooling. You can always depend on Propane Plus. Check out DePietro.com, DePietro.com, all our links to social media, exclusive stories and videos waiting for you at DePietro.com. The Lodge Pub and Eatery, 40 Breakneck Hill Road in Lincoln. Lunch, dinner, drinks in the lounge, especially this time of year. So much going on. They always have a nice crowd right there. Full bar, large dining area right there in the lounge. Easy to get to, whether it's lunch or dinner. A great meal is waiting for you at the Lodge Pub and Eatery. Think of this, since 1994. That's right, celebrating the big anniversary this year. I'll see you at the Lodge Pub and Eatery, 40 Breakneck Hill Road in Lincoln. You're listening to the John DePietro Show. So controversy in Cranston, where now you have some activists. They're upset because of what's happening, where you had a Hispanic individual who approached Friday morning, approached a 14-year-old girl who was going to Cranston East, and he tried to speak Spanish to her. And she said, he said to her something like, "You have a nice body." And then she said, "Excuse me? Like, I'm only 14. He said, "That's okay." And he grabbed her arm. Now, she pulled away, and it's described as a Hispanic man speaking Spanish, and then they have his picture. Well, now some activists are upset over the fact that, number one, it was described as a man under the guise of you don't know what the gender is, meaning how that person identifies. And number two, they don't like the fact that he was identified as Hispanic. So I did a TikTok video on this, and I would play it quickly. Breaking news out of Cranston, Rhode Island. 14-year-old girl grabbed by the arm as she was walking to school. There's the suspect. Described Hispanic man speaking Spanish to her. She's trying to make conversation, tell her she had a nice body. She said, "Excuse me, I'm 14 years old. He said, "That's okay." He tried to grab her by the arm. She broke away, told a crossing guard, and now police are searching for the suspect. Now here's the controversy that is breaking out. Activists are upset because the description went out saying Hispanic man speaking Spanish. They would prefer that it should not say Hispanic or even man. What do you think? I think when a crime is committed, and again, why would that suspect grab a 14-year-old girl walking to high school by the arm and then trying to, who knows what was going to happen, most likely a migrant? What do you think? Don't you think the most descriptive description of a suspect should go out, whether it's white or black, Hispanic, whatever it may be? Controversy in Cranston. Manhunt is on for the suspect. A 14-year-old girl grabbed as she was just walking to high school. Cranston police are on the case. We'll be following it on the scene live stream.
You know, I find it, I'm not surprised by this. This has become the new way. Sometimes the media goes along with it. Most times, hopefully, that they do not. But it is kind of like the new way that they feel they might be offending someone if they put how they're described. If there's a bank robbery and or any type of robbery, if it happens to be a person of color, there's a lot of activists now. They don't want the description to go out that it was a person of color. In the past, they were saying you should just say it was a man that stole it. And many times, as I've pointed out of recent years, that a lot of times the media will go along with it. Not all the time. Now, because of the political correctness with the gender crowd, now they don't even like that if a gender is assigned, meaning in this case, Hispanic male. So I think it's, I think it's foolishness. When a crime or suspected crime is committed, whatever the depiction, description of that individual is, if it's a white male, then the description should be it was a white male. If it's an Asian female, then it's an Asian female. If it's someone who is Hispanic, speaking Spanish, part of the description should be that it happened to be a male and speaking Spanish. Now, if in fact they catch this person and the person says, well, I don't identify as a man, well, that really has no bearing on the case. It's really just the depiction. To me, this is almost the equivalent of someone trying to argue that, the suspect was described wearing a red jacket when it was actually maroon or pink or what have you. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is they have photos of the suspect. It was a 14-year-old girl, and her description was that he was speaking or trying to speak Spanish to her, and then this happened. So I find it ridiculous. I think the most important factor here is that they find the perpetrator, not so much trying to placate many of these activists. Folks, you're listening to the John DePietro Show. You're listening to the John DePietro Show. Folks, I always tout our website just because it has exclusive stories and video. It has links to On the Scene live stream. Remember, there's no vowel I. It's DePietro.com, DePietro.com. You can also reach me that way if you'd like to get in touch with me. DePietro.com, log on, and then links to Facebook and YouTube, everything we have, it's all waiting for you right there at the website.